Hello, everyone. Welcome to the end user experience track. If I may be so bold, do we have any end users here? See, this is the problem. So each one of you, I know we've got consultants and labs here. So your assignment is that for our next meeting, since it's only in like 6 months or so, that you need to start recruiting from the people that you know care about FIPS and common criteria, and then tell them that Canada is going to be a great place for them, and that they need to come and visit us. So welcome to the end user experience track. We have two wonderful speakers here today from Oracle who are going to be talking about going into the woods, but I think they mean that figuratively, not literally, but I'm not quite sure given the picture now. So we have Valerie and we have Jaime who will be talking to us today. Both of them have been at Oracle for quite some time and are power women for the women here in the audience. Woo! Go women. Three women on a stage at one time. Amazing. So, Valerie, she is a software engineering manager at Oracle with over a decade of experience in computer security. She's currently managing the Solaris cryptographic technologies team, of which she was a designer and a major contributor. Pretty impressive. And Jaime is a principal software engineer, not an easy feat, in the Solaris Security Technologies Group. She helped develop the cryptographic framework for Solaris operating system based on the PKCS number 11 standard. Join me in welcoming these ladies as they talk to us about moving into the woods.
Thank you very much.
I don't know, this might be a literal talk, you can't tell. So my name is Valerie. As mentioned, I've been working on security for, it's actually pushing on closer to two decades at this time. I've been involved from Sun Microsystems and now Oracle, and working in the cryptographic technologies area since 2001, and before that on firewall technologies, which also had encryption. Imagine that. So I would like to, and I also be with Jaime, here, you've seen her, so. I talked here last year with Darren about our experience as an OS vendor going through for our first real time actually completing a FIPS validation and all the horrors and everything that we went through. And it's very similar to what's been happening, you know, in recent years at Yosemite, where I took this picture this last spring. As you can see, it's been burned, and there was quite a significant amount of damage, but the forest is surviving even with these wounds, and beautiful flowers are still blooming there in the spring. So I like to think of our experience as similar. So we enjoyed our last validation of Oracle Solaris 11.1 so much that I told my engineering team, let's do it again. And then they did this. And I said, oh, come on, please. It wasn't that bad. You know what? We've already done it. It can't be that hard to do it again, right? So we're still stuck on terminology. So we started working with our consultants, as you do, and for a potential future validation, because you'd like to work early on. And they started saying, oh, we need all of your public APIs. All of your APIs have to be public for us to test. Our engineers on my team started panicking because all of our APIs aren't public. And it's like, what? So this is a terminology issue between ourselves and the consultant. Basically, the consultant, when they're saying public, they mean something that's in a header file, something they can access from their libraries or their test programs. For an engineer, public means something our customers can use. Very big difference. Solaris, for example, Solaris 10 shipped in 2005. We will be supporting Solaris 10 and all of those public interfaces until 2021. So that's 16 years. And a lot of these interfaces that Jaime specifically is going to talk about that our consultants have been asking for in order to test FIPS, we would not, first of all, not want our customers to have, and second of all, not want to support them for 16 years. So we have a terminology differences. So perhaps our gripes are specific to us. We are an OS vendor, and we face very specific problems. But Solaris? I mean, come on, Solaris isn't the biggest OS out there in the world. We aren't the only OS vendor using FIPS verified cryptography either. Linux, Windows, macOS, I mean, there's many platforms and plus lots of specialized OSs as well that are interested in the FIPS story. So it gets a little complicated. Because we're an operating system, we have a different scenario than many other vendors. We have userland and kernel modules. Kernel is very foreign to many other people in the FIPS world because everything's thought of like an application, like OpenSSL, for example, something that runs on top of the operating system. This is another terminology difference. We're talking about software modules, and that means something very specific to software developers. It's an ELF binary, a binary format, computer language, something that you can pass to others and they can run. Module means something else to FIPS people, so we get stuck here sometimes. So what's interesting about Solaris specifically is we have what we call the Solaris cryptographic framework. The kernel level stuff, the modules that are loaded at boot time, and the user level libraries, which are loaded as needed and by different processes, some long running, some short running, we actually build them from the exact same source code. The only difference is the APIs, but the kernel modules, the core cryptographic algorithms themselves, AES.C. You know, we compile and build that for two different versions of our APIs. The exact same source code. But yet we end up, because we have kernel modules and then userland modules, with two boundaries and all the complications that come with having that. And part of that is due to the APIs do vary. Userland, we use PKCS11, which is a standard-based API, and a private uCrypto API that's used by things like Java or the database for high-end, highly optimized cryptography. We also have a proprietary private API for our kernel. It looks a lot like PKCS11 because it was simpler for us from a developer standpoint. But due to the way FIPS is defined, we end up with two boundaries. That's great. Who cares? Poor Solaris, cry me a river. And this is something I actually brought up during the workshop on Monday. So we can't use the DRBG from our userland boundary in our kernel boundary. It's the same source code. We have to have two DRBGs. And I should say it would be the same source code, but we've ended up actually duplicating our source code here so that we have two separate DRBGs to be separately validated. Who likes duplicating code? Nobody. That's really weird. There was actually a talk yesterday about how the more lines of code you have, the more bugs you're going to have, and the scientific research behind that. And duplicating code just seems like a really bad idea, and it makes my engineers make really funny faces when I ask them to do so. But we've done it. But wait, there's more. So I mentioned Solaris has two boundaries. We actually have at least three, because we're gluttons for punishment. So Chris was mentioning earlier OpenSSL. The whole world depends on it. 7.1 million web servers are using it. I'm kind of surprised there's 7.1 million web servers, what's out there. But there are, I mean, between internal web servers, external facing points, everything like that, there's, so if we were to tell our customers, yes, we're an operating system, but no, we're not gonna have OpenSSL, they would become very irritated with us. So we have OpenSSL, and well, these same customers also want it to be FIPS validated, so okay, we've got three boundaries. Oh, wait, you wanna use NSS as well? Oh, okay, well that works on Solaris. Well, you want that FIPS validated, oh, okay. And now what else do you want to use? So we actually start getting a very complicated boundary problem on our operating system. And we can't share. Now, it was mentioned on Monday that you can call an approved DRBG from another boundary. The problem is, there's multiple problems. We're going through, like with our userland and kernel modules, at the same time through validation, so one of them's not done before the other. I mean, sometimes there's some timing differences, and I think our userland finished 3 months before our kernel, or maybe vice versa last time due to the CMVP queues. But in general, we can't guarantee that. But also an important note, because we can't change the code after we've gotten our certificate, our validation is completed, well, actually after we submitted, you can't turn on a bit that says, oh, hey, I'm FIPS validated, you can use me, I'm safe. You can't do that. So there's no way programmatically for another thing like OpenSSL to say, oh, when I'm on Solaris, if I check this bit, I'll know that they're validated and I can use their DRBG. So we're just gonna write our own DRBG. So we're reinventing the wheels. And as an operating system, we actually supply FIPS, what will hopefully become FIPS-validated interfaces, system calls, get random, and get entropy for those people who really want to drain our entropy pools. But these are system-level calls that will be available to everyone on this operating system documented in man pages. So OpenSSL could use it, NSS could use it, but they don't know when or if we are going to validate, so they have to do their own. So then this topic comes up again, and this makes my engineers make funny faces. The consultants ask for things, and they say, well, we have to have this because CMVP is requiring we have it. And, you know, if it's good for the consultant, it should be good for your customers. And that's not true, sadly. So they ask for very odd things. And Jaime's going, because she's the more technical person here, as my lead engineer for the crypto team and the key management team, she is going to tell us about what kinds of strange things that consultants ask for. Thank you, Jaime.
Thank you, Valerie. So I'm going to talk about some of the changes that we have made in order to do the cryptographic algorithm testing that validate the implementation of DSA, RSA algorithm in our modules. So start with DSA. DSA signature generation require a random number. So to generate a known signature, we have to pass a known random number to our signature generation code. So how to do that? It ends up we have to add a backdoor to our code, which so that we can use the pass in random number. Is it good? No, we don't want to keep it in our production system code. Also, we don't want to keep it as a debugging code. Just imagine if we make a tiny, you know, coding error, then we will leave the backdoor in our system. So it ends up we have to make a special version of our binary to do this. And move on to RSA. For the RSA key generation, also we make changes to print out all of the key value and the prime that are generated as a part of the FIP 186-4 implementation, including modulus, public exponent, private exponent, and all the integer random number. So, and also those value, you know, will be used to compute another set of value to see if our implementation is correct. And for the RSA signature generation and verification, we also make changes to use the supply messages so that we can generate the corresponding signature and to validate if the signature is valid or invalid. Again, just like a DSA code, we don't want to ship it in the production system, and so we also make another version of, you know, our binary to do this. And all of this is not trivial, you know, really take a significant engineering effort to do this type of changes. So now I'm going to pass on to Valerie, as I have done all my engineering type of work.
Thank you, Jaime. So as the manager, you know, when I have to ask my team to go spend hours or weeks working on this special code for the consultants, as mentioned in several other presentations already today, that's something else that's not getting done. That's a feature, perhaps a new cryptographic algorithm that's not getting implemented. So who cares? So as Jaime noted, these are backdoors we're creating for our consultants so that they can do testing. This is totally allowed and required, actually. They have to be able to make sure that given a specific, you know, random number, this output comes out. But we can't leave that in the production code. So we're actually forking our own code and creating a separate repository that has these changes in them so we can produce these new binaries. Now, like any fork, the rest of the operating system, because remember, we are a core part of the operating system, sedimented into libraries relied on by the entire rest of the system. You log in to the Solaris box, you're using our libraries, because passwords use encryption too. As was noted earlier, but everything comes through us, SSH, everything's going through our cryptographic boundaries. So we have to then, so we've created a fork, and then the rest of the operating system moves forward, and then we are asked to make a new version to give to the consultants. We have to do a merge, a sync, and it's a ton of effort to make sure we get this right. And this never gets integrated into the production code, which is why it gets out of sync. because quite frankly, it's just dangerous. But why this is important is the binaries that are being tested by the consultants, and this is known, this is known to CMVP, these are not the binaries we're giving to our customers. I don't think our customers know that. The standard is written so that what we test is supposed to be what we're giving to our customers. What has this rubber stamp is supposed to be what the customers get, but it's not what's actually being tested. So it's getting less and less like a real, actual deployment. Why are we doing this? Is it so we can have checkboxes or so we can protect our customers? But we still have integrity. Oh, gosh, then the labs come out, and they want to see our integrity checks fail. Well, that's not going to happen with our real production system, so do another source pool, make a bunch of changes, make sure some, or tamper with some binaries, and so again, they're testing that, and that's fine. They want to make sure that we have actually written the code for failure cases, that failure is not continue on. They want to make sure we're doing that correctly. I understand the need and the desire, but to be clear, this is not the production code. RNG generator test. We specify a fixed random number, verify the result. We needed to provide wrong seeding values to cause it to fail. So again, not like real life. And we're not actually required to list the expected hash value of the modules so that customers can verify they have what we actually validated. Which is what, really? We can keep doing this forever, right? Wrong. So as you all know, it's been mentioned about, I think, 45 times today alone, that the FIPS 140-2 standard is more than 15 years old. That is a millennia in computer technology years. Things, processors have been changing at astronomical rates compared to this standard. Memory modules have been changing at astronomical rates. Operating systems are changing much faster. Already in Solaris, we have protections to make sure that a tampered with binary won't load. So to make these tests, we're having to turn off those features in Solaris to get a tampered with binary to load so that they can see the specific FIPS-related error from our boundary. But I can control the operating system, so I can do that. How is someone else going to verify a module on top of Solaris when Solaris won't let them do that? Then it starts getting even lower than the operating system. We're making massive changes to Spark architecture, Intel is as well, that does protection of memory segments, doesn't allow for tampering, doesn't allow for people to make crazy changes on the system, or would say, well, that certainly looks like a programming error, and trap out. We won't be able to continue on this path. Oops. I know I mentioned it last year, but implementation guidance is not guidance. Ashit even talked about this earlier this morning as well. These are rules. Plain and simple. They are requirements. They're not guidance. This is very confusing for someone new to the FIPS world as a vendor making our code. We did exactly like Ashit had mentioned earlier. We go to our consultants, yeah, we read this 69-page document. We did everything in it. We're ready to go. And they laughed maniacally at us and pointed us to the IGs, and then we cried. So between Solaris 11.1, which we validated a few years ago, 3 years ago, and Solaris 11.3, which was just released at Oracle Open World last week, we thought, well, maybe we might want to validate this, so let's keep up on the implementation guidance, talk to some people, make sure we're doing the right things. Just a few little minor changes. These are not clarifications, no matter how you look at it. They are absolutely, positively not clarifications. To address all of the new IGs over the last 3 years, we had to make over 100 distinct coding changes throughout our operating system. Whew. That was many engineers' effort over many months, not doing anything else. Some of this, the new DRBG 890A, my engineers looked at that and said, this is the right thing to do. We should do this. This is good for Solaris. It's good for security. Let's go. It's not the case with everything. But, you know, we also had a change from FIPS 186-3 to 186-4. That was not an easy jump to make. IG requirements are changed now for how you can set FIPS mode. We had to change how we install our operating system to meet this new guidance. These are far-reaching changes that impact not just the tiny little crypto team. We make a lot of other teams in our organization really irritated. So these aren't clarifications. And this was mentioned, I think, by no less than two other presenters at this conference this week, the no grandfathering, no grace period for the new IGs. This is insanity, because number one, these are not clarifications. In particular, IGA5, ASGCM IV generation. Josh mentioned a product team at Oracle that struggled severely with this. I might know them. So we released our operating system last week. It was announced, John Fowler was up on stage and says, get 11.3, get the new Spark M7, yay, it's great, that's awesome. We didn't finish the operating system last week. We finished it in August, right? It's done. We do a ton of testing, system verification, all of this stuff to make sure it's right before we go out. We were done. We were in emergency bug fix only mode for the entire operating system. And this release is an update to IG 8.5, effective immediately. Well, stop the train, folks. And this is not just my team of engineers. This is not even just my vice president's team of engineers. This isn't even just under one EVP. This affects the entire company, our hardware and our software line to, whoa, slow down. Got to pull all these engineers again off their other projects. Figure out how we're going to comply to this guidance, because it didn't go how we thought it was going to go. We have lots of protections already for our IV generation because we want to protect our customers. We're a public API, though. Lots of people using us. Oh, yeah, that public API, that's PKCS 11 2.40. Just was released in the last year. PKCS 11, a lot of you probably use it or have implementations of it in your systems. It's been around for a long time. I think 1994, a little older than FIPS itself. But we just did a major revision of the standard over the last year. A major revision. We just added AES-GCM support to the standard. You cannot meet this new guidance using PKCS 11 2.40. It is impossible. And it's not even like, well, we're going to 2.41, so we'll fix it there. We will have to go to version 3.0 of the standard, and it will be completely API incompatible with 2.2.01, 2.10, 2.11, 2.20, and 2.40 to meet this guidance. So there's not even that many implementations of 2.40 out there yet. A few of the HSM vendors moved quite quickly and have gotten out there, and you'll see others rolling out over the next few months. They already are not going to be able to comply already. And this is a public API used worldwide. So thanks, CMVP. And because we are an operating system, in order to comply, it wasn't as simple as changing just our cryptographic framework. And I think Ashit mentioned earlier about why vendors want to make really small boundaries, because we can't make changes in them once we release it, once it's validated. We're kind of stuck. We do not want to pull the file system into our boundary. So we had to make quick changes to that for how it was used and pull in a little itsy-bitsy bit. But we couldn't pull in the entire file system. It's ridiculous. It just wouldn't even make sense or be safe for our customers. And so this is where it becomes important, is there are some hardware vendors, they literally do their FIPS validation boundary to the paint on their box. Be careful about which color you choose, though. It has to be available for 15 years or so. But we don't. We're an operating system vendor. We run on top of various hardware platforms, some of which we make the chips for, other which Intel makes the chips for. So we're all tied into the operating system, and because security is so important and encryption is required everywhere, data at rest, data in motion, where do you think IPsec is getting its encryption from? Right here. The file system is getting it from us. The login system, the auditing system, everything is getting its encryption from us, and they're all impacted by this guidance. There's no such thing as a free lunch. You all heard this in your high school economics class, right? No? Tan stuff. Oh. So all these things that I mentioned, we have to stop doing other work. This cost us a ton of money and time. And this isn't just fake money, like, okay, yeah, so your engineers had to stop working on a project, three engineers for 2 months in order to address this IG, or whatever the case may be. We have to, go talk to consultants and other people, and they're not free. And their time's not free. And we have to schedule meetings, and then there's delays, and you get all these things. And, you know, some people have been hit by this new guidance that came out in August. They could have already had their CAVP certificates, and they wouldn't be able to get a CMVP validation. That's not really very fair. How much money have they spent already to get those CAVP certificates, which are now useless? And this also causes contracts to be written, more work to be done by everyone at every level. And the end result is we're delaying getting validated products into the hands of our customers. Customers are often the government, really, to be quite frank. So I'm not sure how they're not even coordinating amongst themselves. And that gets me to one another point, sunsets. So this has come up a little bit today, and I think there's some more talks about it as well. But traditionally, we don't sunset people who've already got a validation. We said, well, your validation's as good as long as you keep selling your product, because you met what the what the criteria was at the time. So SP-890A didn't used to exist, wasn't a requirement. So other products went through using FIPS 186-3, which was the requirement they had to meet, or was it -2? One of those two. So they met the RNG requirements at the time, did all the work. These are hardware products. They can't change. They're dipped in epoxy. So guess what? Oracle won't be selling the SCA 6000 card anymore. So thank you, CMVP. We have lost our FIPS 140 level 2, level 3 product. All right, and we're not alone. So this is business. This is our livelihood. And for our customers, what the heck does a FIPS 142 validation mean anyway? You know, Glenn mentioned a lot of people just use these as checkboxes. So you can just even say FIPS. You know, I might have the pigeon carrier standard going or something, and they'll be quite happy. So yes, we have FIPS. Oh. But we're getting more knowledgeable customers. They really want to know, when did you validate? But now they don't even have to know. That's not even sufficient. They would have to be very, very smart customers to know the difference between a product that went through in 2012 and got a certificate and one that would go in 2015 or 2016. Did I mention the over 100 changes we had to make to comply with the new guidance? The certificates look the same. The security policies don't mention which IGs had changed during the product's validation period. We all know the products will be significantly different. So we can't even tell our customers, hey, don't worry, we comply with IG9212-23A1 because you also changed the IG content, so that becomes meaningless as well. So they have to understand all the IGs. They have to know when the IG was updated and what does it mean for the product you're using. Sometimes an IG update really is a minor clarification. The product vendor had already gotten it right, didn't impact them. Other times, not so much. So they have to be very sophisticated. They have to know when did the vendor submit to CMVP, because sometimes if you're already in the queue, you don't have to do the new guidance. But sometimes, even if you're already in the queue, too bad, so sad, do the guidance again. So the customer also has to know what changed between when you went into the queue and when you came out. And they have to cross-reference all of this. So it becomes very confusing. And I love this little clip art from our art department. It shows a very confused engineer trying to figure out security problems. But it really is very difficult. And you remember, these are the same customers that when you talk to them about cryptography, I'll meet them, you know, walking around on the show floor of another conference, wouldn't be at this one. And they say, what do you do? I say, I manage the Solaris Cryptographic Technologies team. And they go, what is that? They go, well, you know, encryption. And they go, huh? And they go, you know, keep your credit card secret when you're using a website to buy something. And they go, oh, yeah, data scrambling. Okay, yeah. These are the customers making purchasing decisions, okay? They're not going to understand this. We shouldn't make it that hard. We should be honest with ourselves, with the government, and with our customers. If every vendor was doing the same thing, but NIST wasn't happy and it wasn't what they wanted, then it clearly wasn't obvious and it clearly was not a clarification. One vendor, yes, there was the vendor, the infamous vendor, I don't know who they are, but I'll give them dirty looks next time I see them if I ever find out, but that used all zeros for their IV. Very silly mistake. Now we will all be punished. The latest implementation guidance are really new revisions. So why don't we do, you know, we can't get a new standard per se, but why don't we, you know, as a vendor, I don't just say, okay, here's Solaris 11.1, and then apply changes on it and still call it 11.1. It becomes 11.1 SRU1. And our versioning information, if you look at package info entire, will be 5.11.3. whatever. It will show you, you can see this is exactly what version I have. The IGs, at the very least, should rev as they are changed. So, .1, .2, .3, A, B, C, D, double Z, whatever we get to. It would be great if the actual standard would rev as well, if a minor revision like that would be possible without getting the Secretary of Commerce to sign. To be clear that PIPS 140-2.2 has all of these IGs at this version level. So, it's not all doom and gloom. If we do work together on this, we can actually get there. We can make this work, and we can get this together. We can make vendors happy by reducing our time to deliver FIPS validated modules. We can make our customers happy because they'll get them faster. We can make the vendors again happy by saving them money, by making things more obvious, by not dropping changes on their lap unexpectedly and causing fire drills. We can make NIST happy by having us all understand what we're doing, and then they'll get better reports. It'll be easier for them to process. So we have to really be, I had my notes here, just be sensible. Remember that, you know, time is really money. It's silly. And everybody's time is valuable, and everyone in this room, I'm sure, will say they are overworked. So let's be respectful of each other as well. Try to be consistent with terminology. The terminology that Jaime and I are using today is pervasive in the software engineering development space. I don't know why the government uses something else, but clearly I would like to see in future revisions more common terms, and you can see my talk from last year for some more examples of that. But let's work together. Let's, you know, when we're thinking about a new IG, I love the ideas earlier about using CMUF to review and give changes back to CMVP, but CMVP also needs to listen, work together, and we can come up with better products that will make us all make this happy face. So thank you very much, everyone, and I hope you have great validations, and please do let us know if you have any questions.
Are there any questions?
Anyone from CD&D want to respond to some of the suggestions?
And that's that varies from the current IG review, which is optional.
Now, how many years do you guys have been sending the IGs out more frequently recently, you know, to get, but this would be a little bit different. It would be like public review, not just here sending it to the labs, send it to your vendors.
Is that it's a more public review, and then there's a response to comments that has to happen. I'm not completely familiar with this, this person, but,
and specifically, I mean, just on the 19790, I know the question came up, well, the comment came up yesterday from NIST saying, we didn't get a lot of feedback. These documents are expensive. Site licenses are very expensive and difficult to get approvals for. I think you probably didn't get a lot of comments because it costs a lot.
Questions that NIST had actually identified in that federal registry, which is why it might
But there's, yeah, there's the comments were light specifically because of what the questions were asked, but also I did not have my entire team review those documents. I had two people review those documents.
Do you recall like what the site license, do you have like in the ballpark?
No. It was, and
significant.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's very different. You know, for example, there's OASIS, which is an international body, and, you know, for the PK611 TC, we have members from all over the world, from Asia, EMEA, all over, working on this standard, and it's 100% totally free. Anyone can download the results, and basically the companies are paying for this by donating their engineers' time and paying a fee to OASIS to participate in the program. It's not that way for ISO.
Sure.
So it's very expensive. So that's, we're not looking forward if we have to pay to get implementation guidance either. So, but that's coming from NIST. So that's good to hear. But if we get new revisions, again, it's payments and goes, and they're very restricted. It's not like I can pay and get a license for three people and then pass the document around. It's per person, so. Needs access.
So we really gotta share those licenses around. So if everyone's gotta get, if you buy a large site license for a company that large, it gets to be quite expensive, depending on how many versions of the ISO standard you're gonna buy.
Right, and not just the ISO standard itself, but all of its related standards as well. I mean, we're already paying to get the ANSI standards for new algorithms and things like that. And and then somebody has to pay to get it so they can read the standards, so they can review the code, and it's very process heavy. Functionality.
Yes, we heard that.
Yeah.
Yes, but ANSI still charges. Yeah, it is a little cheaper through ANSI, but it is still pay. You still have to pay. Any other questions? Or yes. That's right. Well, when the lab comes on for a site visit, they are aware because they're asking us to trip up this failure functionality, which is actually very interesting. It was the point I actually forgot to make. When we're doing that, so we've created a special version that's going to fail integrity checking, so they can see that it's got the failure code in it. That's a separate source code fork. We've made a source code fork of the entire OS to get this to happen. They have no way of knowing that we didn't only add the failure code to that fork. You know, there is some source code analysis and all that, but you know, if you're gonna trust us to make this fork to see our failures, you can trust us to do a lot more things as well, because there's all kinds of areas. If we were really up to shenanigans, we could fool the government. It's not in our best interest. We think there is value and merit to the standard. We want to comply. We want to do the right thing for our customers. So a little trust would go a long way in that way, but there's nothing. They are aware, the consultants are aware, that we don't want to put a back door in our product to let someone specify having an API where you can specify the prime numbers. So that's clearly not the product we're shipping to our customers. They do tests on the final binaries as well, but a lot of the testing is not done on the final binaries. So, you know, why bother? That's correct. It's a fork of the actual production code.
Yes. So it's almost like a simulation of how the what the code is and how it functions. We just need to put access points into our code, which is not in the production environment in order to do our fixed testing.
And in order to do that as well, it's incredibly resource intensive. And there are some better ways. I mean, you can use dtrace for a lot of this stuff, and dtrace is available on multiple platforms, and you know, so that does kernel inspection or user level module inspection, memory inspection. There are other tools, but that's not what we do. We have to make massive source forks and build different binaries, which takes, you know, a month of an engineer's time that they could be doing something else. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, so we cannot, I probably can't say specifically how many, but there's several hundred engineers working on Solaris. I cannot educate them all on this. I can't even educate my entire team on these issues. I mean, we do, and we go through the training, and I do training, you know, I did it a few weeks ago for my whole team, but, you know, go forward 8, 9, 10 months, the people who aren't working on FIPS-specific stuff will start going, well, what do you mean I can't change this code and, you know, our source, our public tree for our marketing release or whatever the stuff that's out to the customer. Why not? But we've also had, because education at this scale is impossible, we also have put in automated checks that will see when someone's making a request to integrate to the operating system, it checks their binaries and the source files that they're modifying. And if it's one of ours, my team gets a notification and we go yell at them and tell them to get out of our code. But that's because you can't educate. It just, you can, but it's, unless they're interested. Yeah, and I mean, I'll be, next week I'm going to a different team and I'll be talking about FIPS to that team as well. And I know Chris does that all the time. And we go, we do little road shows and then people go, boring, and then that's that. So yeah, tools, we have to use tools to stop people from making changes.
Again, takes more of your time.
Takes more of my time. Well, that was actually another team's time, but you know, I had to design it and then get another team to convince them that it was important, and I couldn't do it, so then a director from another organization had to convince their director that it was important, and then it happened. So any other questions? Yes? The product has been pulled. So.
But it's not available for procurement.
That's right. And support will be ended shortly as well.
Okay. So, but I just want to say that that's not official. There's no, we're still thinking
about it. Well, I think you're specifically talking about is the, someone else from a lab or consultant could probably help straighten me out, because I also get confused in this area, but it wasn't just me that's got confused, because that's actually a different product group. That's in a completely different division. They're a hardware team, because they dip things in epoxy. But our understanding, I've heard only recently in the last couple of weeks about the actual removing the certificates from the web page, but there has been more talk over the last few months, going back to, I think, July, about these validations won't really be considered, they won't be, people can't procure these anymore. So.
There's the RNG, right?
Well, yeah, the RNG is a whole thing.
Yeah.
So this is based on the RNG.
Okay, well, yeah, so that's, oh, okay. Well,
so they, because they don't meet 890A,
yeah.
Because they were developed in 2006.
Okay. Sorry,
so. Yeah. So that's that for them.
And then the other one is there was some dialogue about, I think the date actually changed from Alan when he said yesterday to what we were talking about on Monday, I believe. It sounded like it would move from 2011 to 2010.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
but there's some dialogue with sunsetting things that are approximately 5 years.
Right. And that's really hard because, as I mentioned, we support our products to our customers for 16 years. But I hope that NIST will consider that our support lives are quite long. Yes, Ashit?
So there's a difference between support and procurement, right? So you support it for 16 years, that means you're not selling the same SKU for 16 years.
People can still buy Solaris 10. Mm-hmm. And we released it in 2005. We do updates about every year, but we stopped doing updates last year, and now we're on a quarterly patch cycle with it. They can still procure it on new hardware. Yes, Solaris 10 is a huge market. It took us probably almost that full 10 years to get people off of Solaris 8, which was the previous popular release that people ran for, I think that was 15 years as well.
We have time for one more question. Anyone? You did have your hand up.
Yes, Alex? And that, you know, these systems go into submarines, et cetera. They're not rolling these over very often. The customers who want this stuff the longest are government, typically. So, you have something to think about. All right, thank you.